We're really keen on people getting experience of working in rural areas, because if you've never done it, the fear factor might keep you away. And doing it when you're at a fairly early stage in your career is a good way of actually testing it out, seeing if it's for you.
Hello and welcome to the World Extreme Medicine Podcast. I'm Dr. Marcus Stevens, and today we're joined by Dr. Kate Dawson. Welcome to the podcast, Kate.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here, although a trifle nervous, but anyway, we'll see how it goes.
I'm really looking forward to it as well. So Kate is a GP currently working on the Isle of Benbecula in the Outer Hebrides. She trained in Edinburgh before moving to North Uist to begin her GP training. She now works as both a GP and clinical lead for the Uist and Barrow Hospital. So over the last year, I've been lucky enough to work in a couple of rural areas in Scotland. And so I'm very excited to hear from someone today who spent a career working in certainly one of the more remote places in the UK, hearing about what that work's been like, and maybe comparing a little bit to some of my GP work. So Kate, thanks again for joining us. And I'd be really keen to hear a little bit about what you've done and what first took you to work in the Outer Hebrides.
There's kind of an assumption there that this was planned, but it absolutely was not. So as you said, I did my undergraduate training in Edinburgh, but I always had slightly itchy feet. So after my junior house jobs, I volunteered with voluntary service overseas and worked in northern Nigeria running a small leprosy unit. And when I came back to the UK, I didn't really know what I wanted to do apart from finish my GP training. And it just so happened there was a vacancy in North Uist to train with one of the outstanding names in general practice, Dr. John McLeod. And his father had been part of the Highlands and Islands medical scheme in the 1920s. So it was almost like a direct line of evolution from the Highlands and Islands medical scheme to Dr. John to me. And I was one of his last trainees. So I spent a year there just thinking it was going to be a year. But while I was there, I met my husband and we got married and I ended up with a job in Benbecula medical practice. And I've been there ever since. And just as an interesting aside, after I'd been in Benbecula for about 20 years, I started to get a bit fidgety and my children were getting older and I was wondering what I was going to do next. So I went on an extreme medicine course in Devon. And found out that I was probably as highly qualified as half of the tutors and had done at least as much as them. But it was definitely interesting. And the key focus for me there, my big learning for me there, is the importance of leadership and culture. And it was really interesting meeting the mountain guides. So I took that learning back to Benbecula and it's been part of my practice ever since. So that's how I ended up here.
Fascinating. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to get you on the podcast was actually, I think lots of our listeners will have, you know, grand dreams of working in all sort of manner of fascinating parts of the world, you know, remote and austere and challenging areas. And actually, I think until recently, I didn't realize just what sort of opportunities there were, you know, in the UK. So really keen to explore sort of some of that today. And yeah. Could you just paint us a little picture, Kate, of what the medical system is like on Benbecula? So, you know, how many practices are there? You know, how many hospitals? How many beds? Just kind of what would a classical sort of patient pathway be through the healthcare system?
Okay, yeah. So island medicine. So there's quite a lot of islands off the coast of Scotland. And interestingly, each of the island health boards has a different way of tackling those issues. So I'm in Benbecula, which is part of the Outer Hebrides off the west coast of Scotland. It's a 2-hour ferry ride from Skye to get to North Uist, or a slightly longer ferry journey from Loch Boisdale in South Uist to get to Mallaig or Oban. And the three islands, the three main islands that are part of the Uist chain are Benbecula, North Uist and South Uist, but there's a few little islands offshore as well. And they're connected by causeway. And we've got three practices. It's quite a long drive from top to bottom, a couple of hours anyway, and a population of under 5,000. So it's very widely dispersed. But actually, when people talk about remote, I think we go, what do you mean by remote? Because it's a very close community. People know each other. Our systems have to be quite resilient. So for all of the fact that we're off the west coast of Scotland, we've got most of the facilities that you'd expect, like high schools, shops, post offices, and a hospital. And our practice has the contract at the moment to run the community hospital, and I'm the clinical lead. So for those just under 5,000 patients, the hospital provides beds for all of those people. So it's a 16-bedded unit. It used to be more, but it's contracted to 16 beds because we can have enhanced staffing for those 16 beds. There's a maternity unit with a midwife. We don't plan to have deliveries locally, but of course they do sometimes happen. And we've also got a dental suite as part of the hospital in development, an A&E department with x-ray and outpatient clinics, and we get visiting consultants coming to deliver outpatient clinics. And a really good physiotherapy and OT department. So all of the AHP services are based fairly close to the hospital. Our practice covers the island of Benbecula and some of South Uist. So our practice population is about 2,300, 2,400. One of the things that's happened during the 30 odd years that I've been working here is that the population has been getting older, and you can see that families are getting smaller as well. And a lot of people leave to go to the mainland, to go to college or university, and don't necessarily come back. So we've definitely got the more traditional way of life and the older population at one end of the scale, and then a few people moving in and younger families and some people moving back. But an increasingly large population of older people who don't really want to leave the island in their last decades of life, and are particularly keen on staying locally and accepting local care rather than being shipped off to the mainland. And that makes for some interesting discussions about what kind of care we can provide. I mean, obviously, I'm trained as a GP, not a general physician or an emergency physician, and providing that extended care in the community setting has led to us expanding our skills. And I've been here for 30 odd years, so I don't really know what I've learned above and beyond being a GP, because it's just the way I work. But I am aware that we do have extended skills. And one of the key things, if we've got somebody coming to work with us, is we tend to find that the younger GPs who have not long since left hospital medicine find it a little bit easier to slot into what we do. And we're also very keen on people who've done the basic Scotland course, which is the pre-hospital emergency medicine course, which gives you some really solid grounding in what to do when you're presented with something that you haven't actually dealt with before in an emergency situation, and the good solid ABC skills.
Fascinating. Really interesting to hear about the population evolving like that. I imagine that must bring, you know, significant challenges, and I think we'll come on a bit later on to talk about that kind of preventative medicine and perhaps planning ahead. But you mentioned pre-hospital care, and lots of the listeners will be paramedics or working within the pre-hospital care services. How much of your role is on the roadside perhaps, or outside of the clinic or hospital?
Not a huge amount, to be honest. We have got an advanced practitioner paramedic based in our team, and most of our ambulance crews have got a paramedic on board. And we do go to dual responses. I think the thing about the pre-hospital emergency care is that it doesn't happen very often, and it's very challenging keeping our skills up. I mean, we should be going on some kind of refresher course every year, but with only a small pool of GPs, number of courses, it's very difficult to release everybody every year to go and get their refresher done. So Basic Scotland do something called a passport course. So every year, one of us gets to go on one bit of a refresher. And that might be paediatric, it might be maternity, it might be pre-hospital, it might be traumatic cardiac arrest, the deteriorating patient. All of those little segments are rehearsed regularly. And the other thing that we do is we have very good patient pathways. So, for example, I would say we probably get a major trauma about once every 5 years. And knowing to do exactly the right thing at the right time and having to dredge that up out of your memory is quite a trick. And we know that the skills that you learn on basics tend to start to fade away after about 3 months. So we've got a really robust and well-tested trauma plan. And that arose from us trying to deal with somebody who'd been thrown from a car that had come off the road at speed. And he eventually died of traumatic chest injuries. But it was very stressful for everyone that was involved. There seemed to be no sort of coordination about who did what and where everything was stored. And while the hospital had all the resources and everybody had been trained, it was stressful. So we wrote the trauma pathway in conjunction with some GPs on the island of Arran, who've got a similar population, and an emergency medicine consultant in North Wales, and came up with our own trauma pathway. And we actually got a chance to test it out a few years later when somebody else came off the road at speed. And as an aside, in rural areas, there's in Canada and Scotland and many other remote and rural places, young men tend to entertain themselves by driving extremely fast on rural roads in the dark. And with mobile phones, it's very easy to work out where the police are and keep everybody up to date. So it was unsurprising, really, that somebody did come off the road at speed. But we ran the pathway and it worked extremely well. Most of the people who were involved in that emergency retrieval commented at the end of it how calm it had felt, the fact that we'd actually managed to package the patient up in extremely good time. And he came out of the other end of his traumatic accident in pretty good nick. The only thing that we've added since then is a hot debrief page at the back to make sure everybody's okay and a bit of psychological safety built into that. That's an idea of how often these things happen, where our training kicks in, but also the importance of good leadership skills and having good paperwork. I would add that another really good course that I've been on is the European Trauma Course. And I don't know if everybody is familiar with that, but it focuses a lot more on teamwork in trauma and making sure that you use your resources wisely. It's not about individual skills. It's about how you work as a team and how you work as a team leader in difficult situations. So it's a very well recommended course and I really enjoyed doing it.
That's fascinating to hear, and what a brilliant outcome from what sounds like two sort of both very difficult cases. But you know, to see that progress, you know, some years later through all of that work must have been very rewarding.
It was, and since then that pathway has been adapted and adopted elsewhere. So it's now in use in another hospital further north in Stornoway, where all of our secondary care facilities are based.
Excellent. That's really interesting. And you mentioned, obviously, I suspect these patients, major trauma patients, are probably well outstripping the resources you have at the local hospital. What would the ceiling of care be there? And what are their options for referral onwards to the mainland for patients, you know, suffering, for example, major trauma?
As anybody who's worked in a remote and rural area will understand, is the bulk of our work is the bread and butter stuff. It's exacerbations of COPD, it's children with sore throats or a funny rash. So not all of it is drama and excitement. So for us, our ceiling of care is we're not terribly keen on people who are unwell under the age of 5, because they can get scarily unwell extremely quickly. And what we do for paediatrics is we get most of our support from the Royal Hospital for Children in Glasgow. There is a paediatrician in Stornoway, but if we've got somebody who's sick enough to be shipped off, shipping them off to Glasgow is quite often the place where we would head for. And then for adults, we can provide ward level care. But as soon as somebody requires some kind of high dependency care, we would be talking to the patient and the family about the need to be transferred away. And that's where things like anticipatory care planning or treatment escalation plans, different terminology in different areas, that's where that comes in. So as soon as you get to people who've got very low risk of low chance of survival, if they particularly want to die on the island and would rather have their ceiling of care as ward level care, then we can do that. So it's flexed a little bit according to what's realistic and what's safe. If somebody is sick enough to be transferred away, our main option for transferring them is by air ambulance. And that's just like ordering a road ambulance, except it's got wings. You phone up, you give the patient details, and they tell you that they're going to phone you back. The aeroplane's in Orkney or it's out of service. It's going to be another 7 hours. They need to do a handover. So that's fairly steady. So you wouldn't use that for somebody who's really critically unwell. One exception would be if you've got something time critical, like ST elevation MI or a stroke where thrombolysis may be an option. Those come into the slightly more urgent category. For those time critical ones, if the air ambulance is not available, we sometimes get the Coast Guard helicopter coming to pick them up to get them to Stornoway or to Glasgow. Stornoway does our CTs and stroke management, using a remote stroke consultant from Aberdeen on a video link. And chest pain patients get airlifted to CCU in Glasgow somewhere. For patients who are really critically unwell, who need to be transferred to a high dependency or an ITU type setting, and we have the option of ScotStar, which is a retrieval service, and they cover neonates, paediatrics and adults. And they send up a crew of usually an anaesthetist or an emergency medicine consultant or a consultant in retrieval medicine, along with usually a retrieval paramedic and possibly somebody else who's maybe in training. And they come up and assess the patient. Do they need to be ventilated for the transfer? So, for example, the case that I mentioned earlier, the chap who'd come off the road who survived in good nick, he was retrieved. He'd had a basal skull fracture and was in a sort of a Wookiee type scenario. He was gurgling and waving his arms and legs, but not actually talking. So I think he was certainly not alert. But he also was very difficult to keep still, would have been a real risk in an air ambulance. The cases that are the most challenging are actually psychiatric cases, because you certainly don't want somebody with a severe mental health problem loose in the back of an air ambulance wanting to jump out or mess with the pilot's controls. And so they need to have additional support with them. And that takes quite a lot of time to source that. So we sometimes end up looking after acutely distressed and mentally unwell patients in the community hospital while we work out how to get them sectioned and off to a psychiatric hospital. So those are the most challenging ones.
Goodness, what a broad range of pathology and really taken to extremes. For some of those patients, how much remote advice is there? So, for example, you know, psychiatric patients, you know, who are you calling, and is that advice sort of freely available?
Generally speaking, we get really good support from the consultants in the Western Isles Hospital. So if we've got something where we're not entirely sure what we should be doing, somebody maybe with a potassium of 5.8, not super worrisome, but you do need to do something about it, we would tend to get extremely helpful advice from the consultants in Stornoway. For medicine, for surgery, for orthopaedics, and paediatrics. The psychiatry, unfortunately, and I'm sure this is the true right across the UK, but specifically affects us, we've had a series of locum consultants. And so although we can talk to them, we find that actually getting the patients who are sectioned into a secure unit is really quite tricky. Most of the mainland units will only accept a referral from another health board if the patient has been assessed by a consultant. and it's very difficult to get a patient assessed by a consultant when the consultant's on another island. So that can be quite stressful. In general, if we've got something a little bit more alarming, for example, somebody with which we think's got a cord requina or a fracture that requires dealt with in Glasgow, we generally find that the more senior consultants are very happy to speak to GPs from the Western Isles. I think there's an understanding that actually, if we refer them a patient, they're properly sick. Occasionally, we get a bit of a barrier, sort of saying, oh, do we take patients from the Western Isles? Are you sure? Have you phoned the right health board? So we sometimes get that. So we've got a sort of an escalation plan, what to do if we need to transfer a patient off and we're not getting the right answers at the other end. But to be honest, we tend to get very good support from just about everybody we speak to. And it's also a little bit about how you ask. So you make sure that you follow a good standard sort of SBAR type setup. I'm Dr. Dawson, I'm in Benbecula, which is in the Outer Hebrides. I want to talk to you about a really sick patient that we can't keep on the island, and I need some advice. And sometimes posing it as advice, whoever you're speaking to becomes quite engaged in a good outcome. And then they're more likely to say, well, do you know, why don't you just send them to us and we'll sort them out? So it's a little bit about how you frame it. But we do generally get very, very good support.
Excellent advice there on how to approach a conversation. I have to say, I've used the may I just ask a question or some advice here when referring into hospital. And as you say, it normally goes a little bit better than the I would like to refer someone. Yeah. Excellent. And I mean, you've already touched on, you know, some fascinating aspects of island life. I mean, are there bits that you miss? I mean, I suppose you've been there for 30 years. So, I mean, been a long time since you've lived elsewhere, but any particular aspects of island life which you really love, or any little bits that you perhaps miss from other places you've lived and worked?
Oh, golly. Yes, you're right. I've been here for so long, I don't even know what I miss anymore. I tell you what I find terrifying when I go to the mainland is going into supermarkets, and the amount of choice is just overwhelming. I can't manage. I have to kind of like, after a short spell, I think that's too much. I'm just going to grab what I need and run. I've still got quite a lot of family in the south of England. And so when I visit them, what the things that I really enjoy are things like trees. There's not a lot of trees up here. So like walking through woodland, walking through forests is just lovely. It's really nice meeting up with my siblings and sitting down in the evening and having a good old rant about various things and having a chat with them. But when we do get together, it's really, really special. We really enjoy it. I think I also... Well, I wouldn't say I miss the cinema and the theatre quite so much, because when I did live on the mainland, I didn't go that often. But there's a feeling that when something like the performing arts visit the Outer Hebrides, usually on an arts grant, they might be touring, you kind of feel obliged to go to support them, because who knows, they might never come back. So I tend to be a lot more eclectic in the things that I see. One of the most fantastic things is the Screen Machine, which is a cinema on the back of a lorry. Which tours the remote rural areas of Scotland. And it has usually a 4-day stint in Benbecula, where you'll see most of the most recent films, a couple of independent films, usually something with a bit of a local twist. And it's fantastic experience of going to the cinema there. So much, much more likely to come and see stuff here. But when you go, for example, to London, being able to go around the big galleries, being able to see sort of like really fantastic works of art or amazing exhibitions, I really enjoy that. That's something I look forward to when I go away, sort of city break type stuff. And we tend to take city break type holidays. So when we've got the best of remote and rural here, it's beautiful, beautiful beaches, amazing wildlife, lots of archaeology. It is a fantastic place to live. It's a fantastic place to bring up children. So when we're on the mainland, we tend to do the opposite. We tend to go for city breaks.
Fantastic. I'm sure all your family and friends love coming to visit you up in the Outer Hebrides. I've really looked forward to visiting one day myself. All the photos and videos I've seen look absolutely stunning. And couple of friends this summer cycled the length of it, which is a trip that I'd would love to do at some point.
Yeah.
And you mentioned earlier about kind of advanced care planning and also sort of treatment escalation planning for patients perhaps slightly older on the island who wouldn't want to transfer to the mainland and perhaps die on the mainland. It'd be really fascinating to hear a little bit about what opportunities you've got for kind of that enhanced relationship with your patients. I suspect that you know your patients far better than many GPs. And is there a bit more time perhaps to dedicate to preventative medicine rather than perhaps being so reactionary, which is, I think a lot of doctors, a lot of GPs will perhaps struggle with that, of actually lots of the medicine we're doing, we are reacting to something which actually had we intervened months or years before, perhaps we wouldn't be in that situation come down the line.
Oh, golly, that's an interesting question. I think things have been hugely disrupted in the last 5 years anyway. COVID has completely upset quite a lot of the work that we were doing. So one of the best things about working in remote and rural Scotland, in fact, anywhere remote and rural in a small practice, is the relationship with the community in which you work. And so while I'm here, I've looked after people as babies who are now adults. I've got their own children. People that I looked after as young adults are now grandparents, and some of the people that I looked up to when I first moved here are now quite elderly. So there is that real longitudinal care, and that continuity of care is the jewel in the crown of rural general practice. I think, though, that over the last 10 years, we've really struggled to recruit, so we've got fewer partners than we used to have. And so at the same time, the new Scottish contract has added some new members to the team who maybe only work for us one day a week, but will take certain types of problems out of our laps. So, for example, most of the pharmacy questions are dealt with by a pharmacist. We've had a first contact physiotherapist for a while. And an increased reliance on advanced nurse practitioners for taking some of the more straightforward work. And leaving the complex sorting out more to the GPs. And that's kind of upsetting the ecology of that continuity of care a little bit. So you tend to see people a little bit more when things have got complicated, rather than having contact with them all the way through and just being their GP. And there's pros and cons to that, obviously. One of the more interesting things that I did a few years ago was we tried setting up a comprehensive geriatric assessment clinic, and we ran it just as a trial run. When we used the Edmonton Frailty Scale to assess patients, as well as a couple of other cognitive assessment tools. And those patients have very definitely benefited from that, who went through that process, because so much was put in proactively before they had become more unwell. And it's something that is in my plan for this year, is to take another look at that work and see how we can fit comprehensive geriatric assessment into primary care. And there's some evidence emerging in other areas in rural Scotland that that's the approach that works really, really well. And it allows you to get that sort of anticipatory care discussion going long before it's needed. It's really tricky to do that when somebody's acutely unwell and you're introducing the idea to relatives at the first off that perhaps transferring their dad or their uncle off the island is maybe not in their best interests, even though they've got a condition that is clearly outside the scope of a community hospital. And those are difficult conversations to have in an emergency. But if you've done that 5 years beforehand, you've got patients who've already had those conversations. One of the things that the Western Isles is also doing is introducing the respect form, which some people will be au fait with, which is a very simple two sides of A4 approach to getting the basics of the difficult conversations recorded. Which is actually a huge step forward from the old anticipatory care planning booklet, which had pages and pages and pages of easy to read tick boxes type approach, which actually never really got updated and people never really completed because it was so daunting to have a book of your wishes. So yeah, respect's being rolled out locally as well. So all of that is kind of tied in. So part of me is thinking, do you know, is that not good general practice wherever you are? But in a rural area where you've got really close relationships to your patients, I'm wondering if, is it slightly easier or is it slightly harder? For me, I think because I know my patients so well, it's like friends. I feel actually admitting to myself as well as talking to the patient about the fact that they're getting older and frailer, I sometimes find quite difficult because I have to acknowledge that that relationship has moved on a step. And that how I feel about how that person is coping with their ill health, my thinking about that has to move on a step as well.
That's a really interesting insight. I sort of hadn't thought about it that way. I kind of assumed that, you know, knowing your patients better and perhaps having, you know, I don't know whether perhaps a naive assumption that more time with them would make that easier. But I can appreciate that most of the patients I have these very difficult conversations with, I'm probably not going to bump into their son or daughter in the shop or, you know, somewhere, you know, around. And actually that would add significant difficulties or certainly make the whole process a lot more difficult.
It does make it more challenging, but it also creates deeper relationships with the people that you meet in the shop. And so while you might not be stopping to talk to them about their uncle opposite the bananas, or while you're buying your biscuits or whatever, when you acknowledge people in the shop, there's an understanding that you've had these meaningful conversations.
Yeah, a real depth of relationship there. Yeah, fascinating. And you mentioned already various changes over past few years and decades on the island and remote and rural healthcare provision. Are there any major other kind of changes you've seen over the time you've been there in the way you've practiced or others on the island have practiced?
I think the big changes have basically reflected my career. So when I moved here, I came here as a GP trainee and in North Uist, I was there for a year, and it was very definitely a feeling that I had to get the best out of my experience during that year. So I did a lot of walking, I did a lot of exploring, I spent quite a lot of time studying or traveling. It was a time when you traveled away for courses. I spent quite a lot of time traveling away to get different bits of experience. But when I ended up staying here, I was very much the junior in the practice. There was two established partners and I was taken on the retainer scheme, which was two sessions a week. The focus was very much on my young family. And then when they got to the point where I could leave them with a childminder, my husband gave up his job. He was a self-employed chimney sweep. So he stopped doing that in order to look after the girls while I went back to work full time. And quite quickly, I became the sort of audit GP. I really liked data and spreadsheets, which meant that I was kind of looking at perhaps some of our chronic disease monitoring. And it meant that when we moved to QOF, so just to remember, there was a new contract when I started my GP training. There was another new contract when QOF was introduced. And I'm now on to my third new contract. So anyway, when QOF was introduced, we were really well set up because we already had chronic disease registers and standards of care for those people with chronic diseases. But as the populations got older, actually focusing on chronic diseases has been quite unhelpful. It's meant that we've been focusing on treating to targets rather than being more holistic about people with multimorbidity. And I've been quite glad to be able to drop QOF and focus on patients instead. But in the last 10 years, I think what I've focused on more is quality improvement and patient safety, and looking at culture within organisations and looking at a positive culture, certainly in the workforces that I work with. And that's the workforce within the practice where I'm a partner, but also the workforce in the hospital when I'm in the clinical lead. And those have been very valuable approaches. And I think we've got really strong teams, really strong positive teams. really good at focus on feedback and looking at what we've done and making sure that we're doing the best that we can do.
Brilliant. That sounds, you know, really, really fascinating thing to focus on. And, you know, I'm a big proponent for that kind of real deep understanding of culture and how it impacts, and sounds like doing brilliant work there. Just as an aside, what's your split, yourself or sort of other partners at the Benbecula practice, between your GP work and work in the hospital? How is the hospital run? Is there a weekly GP lead, or do you do a daily ward round, or just kind of how does that work?
Obviously, just like being in the middle of it, I don't really think about it very much. Just get up in the morning and do what you're meant to be doing. So I'm the clinical lead, which means I take responsibility for coming up with sort of like future planning and designing how care is delivered, along with the senior charge nurse and with the middle management in Stornoway. But actually, on a day-to-day basis, we try and get a balance between availability both in the practice and the hospital, and also having continuity of care in those two settings. So we split our time fairly evenly. So if I'm just going to glance at it. For example, next week I've got 2 days in the hospital and 3 days in the practice. And then the next week I've got 3 days in the hospital and 2 days in the practice. So it kind of balances itself out. We have a fairly robust approach to handovers. So we have a handover to the doctor going on duty in the hospital every morning to make sure that we go over absolutely every single patient and make sure that the doctor that's coming on knows what actions are required that day for each patient. The other things that we do and have done in the past, we used to do all our own out of hours, but that started to slip maybe about 10, 15 years ago. And so increasingly we were relying on locums to do some of our out of hours, and they'd come up and do a block of nights. And then coming up to 2 years ago, we pretty much stopped doing all of our own out of hours. And that's been run entirely by a series of locums employed by the health board. And it was partly to do with remuneration and partly to do with decreasing number of partners. So when we started doing our own out of hours, there were 6 of us in the rota, and then we got down to 2, and that was really not doing a 1 and 2 on top of general practice wasn't really practical, particularly when we discovered that elsewhere in Scotland people were getting different rates of pay, and we thought we're kind of being taken advantage of here. Let the health board take the strain. So we've got out of hours GPs working in the out of hours service, and generally speaking they've done their basics training somewhere, and we're very careful to ensure that anybody who is doing a locum with us gets included in any learning or any audits or any sort of key any significant events, so that they get their appraisal covered while they're working for us, all of their appraisal material. And that really helps because they feel part of the same positive team. At the weekends, because it's like nearly 2 hours from end to end, we also provide something called second on. So sort of top cover for whoever's covering the out of hours. During the day, one of us is available to provide support if necessary. Because, I mean, if you're in Eriskay, dealing with a chest pain and somebody goes into labour in North Uist, you can't be in both places at once, and you might want an experienced pair of hands to deal with one of those emergencies.
As a GP locum, certainly looking at coming to do a little bit of work in the Outer Hebrides, that's fascinating to hear, and also slightly concerning to have them be called to a labour on a Sunday. But it'd be fascinating to hear what opportunities there are for anyone wanting to come and work in the Outer Hebrides or in other parts of the Highlands and Islands. We've touched on the kind of GP locum cover, perhaps for out of hours and weekends. What other kind of pathways are there for someone wanting to either get some experience in the short term or a longer term commitment to working in rural areas?
We're really keen on people getting experience of working in rural areas, because if you've never done it, the fear factor might keep you away, and doing it when you're at a fairly early stage in your career is a good way of actually testing it out, seeing if it's for you. So we cover pretty much the whole spectrum of helping people to get some rural experience. So we mentor school pupils in our local high school into applying for medical school. We also take undergraduates for their electives. Now, I don't want to be completely over, we're already completely overwhelmed with people writing to us for their electives. So we have to keep quite a tight rein on that, but we do take people for their electives. We no longer are a practice associated with any particular university, because we used to be a placement for Dundee University for doing their remote GP block. But unfortunately, with the falling number of partners, we haven't got the resources to continue to do that at the moment. For people who are FY2, I think you get an experience week. And so we definitely offer slots for people in FY2 who want to come to us for a week. For people who are GP trainees, we have given people the opportunity to come to us for a fortnight. On one occasion, they came with their trainer. On another occasion, it was two trainees who came to teach us about something that was happening in another area, and were they'd done a quality improvement project and spent a couple of weeks doing their out of hours part of their training and then teaching us. So we have taken GP trainees. But the biggest thing we're involved in at the moment is the Rural Fellowship, which is run by NHS Education Scotland, which is a year-long programme, usually for young GPs and people who are in their first five, where you get an extra year. And that is split between service provision and additional training. And we're the base practice for a rural fellow. So we've had two rural fellows, and it has absolutely been fantastic for us. It provides a bit of resilience for us, and they get a year working in a remote and rural setting with experienced GPs who provide supervision. And they get to do a project as well. So our current rural fellow is doing a project on the management of pre-diabetes in rural areas. Is there a gap in what's provided in centralised medicine versus the rural diaspora? So that wide range.
Very tempting.
Yeah. And we do very have tempting. Locums, but we try and get nice locums that we nurture and hope that they come back, because that actually adds to the continuity.
Fantastic. I've heard of the Rural Fellowship before, and I've been very tempted. So perhaps I'll add that, or something to look at doing in the next few years. And you've had a fascinating career, you know, starting early. You mentioned some time in Nigeria. What do you see the next few years looking like? Happy where you are, or interested in looking further afield, or what kind of dreams, aspirations do you have?
Well, interesting times in general practice in the UK, and particularly in Scotland. Most of the GPs in and around the Western Isles are approaching retirement, as am I. And still got slightly restless, itchy feet. Plus, I'm completely committed to the practice and the hospital being successful, of being kind of exemplars about how you can provide rural medical care. So I'm kind of torn. But the way that the health board are looking ahead is they're seeing how difficult it is to recruit people to partnerships. The amount of income that you get into primary care, particularly in rural areas, combined with the fragmentation of the new contract, is making it quite unattractive to become a rural GP partner. You carry quite a lot of financial risk. And at the same time, the board are looking to take back the contract for the community hospital in order to fund some of the unscheduled care requirements that are developing. So our practice is at a bit of a crossroads. So we're handing the management of the practice back to the health board beginning of next year. So we're staying on as partners in order to provide some kind of leadership through that transition, and hoping that the financial risk of becoming a partner and the management risk of becoming a partner, if that's taken out of the equation, that we will be more successful in recruiting our successors. So for the next year anyway, I'll be leading through the practice through that quite significant change, and becoming a practice that's run by the board as part of a healthcare hub, which covers the practice, the hospital, the unscheduled care, and providing that as a strong base for if any of the practices, other practices on the US, if they get to a difficult point, that we've got that robust base in which to actually absorb that change further down the line. So that's the next year for me, after which again, too many choices. Do I start doing voluntary work overseas again? After I did my ex-bed med course, I also used to volunteer for music festivals. So going back to doing that, like going to Glastonbury, going to Leeds, going to Reading festivals to look after the people who've taken too many drugs or broken their ankles while they've been jumping about. So I could do more of that. I could just take up, I don't know what I want to do, but that my next year is really going to be focused on that safe transition, leading the practice through significant change.
Sounds like very challenging time to come, but you know, sounds like very much in good hands, and I'm sure that the practice and the hostel on the island will emerge hopefully better for that. Mm-hmm. I think sort of approaching wrapping up, is there anything else that we've missed that you'd like the listeners to hear, or perhaps an interesting case that sums up you know, some of your sort of work and career on the island?
I was kind of expecting a question like that, and I've been struggling for the last few days to think about how I could come up with a case that doesn't breach patient confidentiality. And I was thinking, do you know, it's not really cases, because they're my patients for 30 years. So I haven't got a specific case. And most of the people I know so well that I find it really difficult to kind of anonymize it, because I know the ins and outs so intensely. I think about perhaps people who live nearby, where I've looked after their parents through significant illness, and then they've come back to me as adults themselves, dealing with their health problems, looking at their children who are at school with my children who've moved away but have then come back and have got children of their own. That's the story about working in remote and rural general practice, doing the house calls on the elderly granny as she becomes more unwell, but then supporting her children through that grief and then supporting them through their own illnesses. And at the same time, being able to celebrate with them, their children getting married, and be going along to those weddings, and then meeting them out and about in the community with the next generation in the pushchair. So yes, it's that longitudinal experience of healthcare that I hope other people will have the opportunity to experience. And if we've got a good system, there's every chance that will continue.
I think that's far better than any particular case, and actually really striking insight to realize that, you know, what I see as a case, or, you know, the way we learn is sort of, you know, actually you can't pull out that, you know, each person you've seen, each contact is, you know, one point on that journey, like you say, all the way through from birth or when you first met them. And yeah, that's not something I've ever really thought about before, that, you know, yeah, you've had a journey with all of your patients, even if, you know, for 10 minutes or half an hour, they've been a particular case, it slots into that journey. And I think actually that's a really striking way to think about a career for most of us. It is, for me anyway, as a locum GP, it's a collection of cases. I see maybe 25 or 30 cases a day. And yes, I enjoy having that continuity, but it's certainly limited. So I think a really appealing way to practice, and a real sort of opportunity to in rural and remote things to experience it.
I've actually just thought of a couple of other different things that I don't know if how they would slot in. While I've been here, I've worked as a hospital practitioner in dermatology, so like a GP with a special interest. And that is very much a contrast to working in the general practice end of things, where absolutely anything can walk in through the door. So doing dermatology has been an attempt to provide a service locally, so people don't have to wait particularly long and haven't needed to travel away to get diagnoses. That's changed during the time that I've done it, in that store and send technology has got better, and a real emphasis on that through COVID, that you can take a photograph of something and send it to somebody and ask for an opinion. But that's been quite interesting, sitting in a consulting room and every single person that you come to see has got a skin problem. And it's an interesting balance between using your GP skills for engaging people and teasing out, you know, like a little bit about their lifestyle and who they are and how that impacts on their skin condition. And actually also using that understanding to help with things like concordance with treatment. So I do like using my GP skills in the dermatology clinic. And that is a little bit more case based. And I think one of the other differences about working in a really remote and rural area is not only having those extended skills, perhaps in an area which you might be interested in, is also that uneasy interface between primary and secondary care, which I think sometimes can be a bit of a battleground. And I know that on the mainland, you see rural practices increasingly pushing back against being asked to do blood tests for secondary care. Whereas, you know, like if I've got a patient with, say, a prostate cancer that needs a PSA done every 6 months under some kind of surveillance scheme, I'm not going to send them to Inverness to get that blood test done when there's only a flight on a Tuesday and a Thursday. So to get the blood test done on a Wednesday, they're away from home two nights. So it doesn't make sense. So we do take on quite a lot of that interface testing. There's still some discussion between primary and secondary care as to who's responsible for looking at those results, and it's something that as a cluster we're working on. But one of the things about remote and rural medicine is that that interface becomes a lot more dynamic, and handled well can actually make the patient care pathway a lot more straightforward and a lot simpler, and it's something that I'm really interested in continuing to work on, and it's a big part of rural general practice.
Yeah, that's really interesting, and I've been struck kind of throughout this conversation by just how much ownership you seem to have of your work, and being able to influence from one end the kind of trauma, pre-hospital trauma pathway, all the way through to looking at, you know, taking on some secondary care responsibilities, and then, you know, how to run a hospital safely, and looking at leadership. It sounds like you've really approached things from a kind of a whole island perspective, sort of holistic, and really sort of advocated for your patients where possible, which sounds like, you know, they're a very lucky population.
Yeah. Well, I'm also struck thinking back is that that also has echoes to working in the leprosy unit in northern Nigeria. So I was a relatively junior doctor at that point, and I had very little experience. But I think those 2 years were really formative. That turned me from somebody with a medical degree into a doctor with a passion for organising the work that I do in a way that makes sure that good care gets to patients. So that was where I was collecting data. I was looking at gaps in the service, applying for funding to set up a community worker training scheme, all of that type of thing. So I can see the roots of what I do now starting there with my voluntary work overseas.
Fantastic. What an amazing career. And well, I really look forward to perhaps meeting one day, Kate, if I come and do a little bit of locum work in the Outer Hebrides. And in the meantime, you know, thank you so much for joining us and telling us all about what sounds like a really, really rewarding and fascinating career.
Thank you very much. It's been very enjoyable.
Thanks for listening to the episode. please feel free to rate, review, and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. Please also head over to the World Extreme Medicine website, where you can find more engaging content on extreme medicine webinars and indeed the collection of courses from our global network, including humanitarian, disaster relief, expedition, space, military, tactical, and performance medicine. Thanks again.